was wired for that one, wasn't I? Yeah. Calling House Judiciary together at 1:20, and today's date is the 17th of March. And if you would call the roll, I would appreciate it.
Representative Grunberg?
Here.
Representative Foster? Representative Ledoux? Representative Lynn? Oh, I thought he was pointing. Okay. Representative Miller?
Here.
Representative Pruitt?
Here.
Representative Keller?
Here. And then for the record, Representative Foster and Representative Ledoux were previously excused. I expect Representative Lynn to be here shortly.
So. On the floor, it didn't show Neil as excused. Was he excused from the floor?
He was excused from the committee, so that's all I know for certain.
Certainly. I asked somebody about that.
Okay, first order of business today is HGR 18. I'd like to put it on the table. Is what's the rule of the committee on HGR 18?
Could I just have a minute? We have some amendments. Are we going to deal with any of those?
Representative Grunberg, if it's okay with you, do you have an amendment?
No.
Okay. We'll see what happens, but are there any amendments for HGR 18?
Can I take a look just a second, please?
No. Well, we'll take a look at what?
The amendments.
There are no amendments.
Oh, these are not? They're
being offered.
Well, I thought I might look at
them. Okay, is there a move on the motion on the bill?
Mr. Speaker?
Representative Pruitt?
Mr. Chair, sorry about that. You can take that as an insult or as a compliment. I move HCR 18 out of committee with the accompanying individual recommendations and I believe fiscal note.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
There's a fiscal note on this one, yes.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to object for discussion.
Okay, sure. Yeah. Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, I just wanted to put on the record that these are amendments we talked about earlier, I believe. And I just wanted to, I didn't know what they were just now.
Yeah.
And I don't intend to offer them.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Just wanted to say that. Yeah. You remove your objection?
Yeah.
Okay. Seeing no other objection, HGR 18, moves from committee, version alpha. Is that clean enough for you there, Darrell? We're going to take a little of these here and pass the paperwork. Record. What we have before us now is House Bill 366. Can I have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move CS for House Bill 366 as our working document.
Version PAPA?
Version P.
PAPA, yeah. P is in PAPA. And Representative Grunberg?
I've had somebody who said they wanted to testify. I'm just wondering if they did call in.
I'll object for purposes of discussion, and what we'll do is ask Representative Pruitt to go ahead and make a presentation, and we'll go from there. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lance Pruitt, representing District 25 in East Anchorage. You have before you HB 366. I appreciate you taking the time to take a look at this bill. HB 366 came about from it was actually requested by the National Shooting Sports Foundation. National Shooting Sports Foundation is an organization that includes people like Smith & Wesson, Ruger, some of the gun manufacturers that you would typically identify with when you think about guns. When I was requested to look at this and determine if it was something I was willing to introduce, I thought about it long and hard, spent about a month and a half thinking about it, trying to determine, you know, was this the right move forward? And in the end, after lots of discussion with some colleagues, as well as people from outside of the building, even, I determined that it was an approach that I felt was important to go ahead and address. This bill will take the information of an individual who has been adjudicated with a 30-day involuntary commitment and it will communicate that information to the National Instant Criminal System Database, which is the database used by the federal licensees, the federal firearms licensees, the background check discussion, when they look up the information, they're looking it up on the NICS database. And when that information comes up, of course, there's only three things that individual sees. It's either a yes, a no, or need a little bit of time. And, of course, that's the three-day waiting period if it needs to look into it a little bit more. This information that we would be passing on to them is very minimal. It does not include the information behind why the individual might have been had the 30-day involuntary commitment. It just has the information that we might have available: their name, their date of birth, maybe their Social Security. But we may not have that. So the bill in front of you indicates what information we have would be potentially communicated. And there's also a provision in here to make sure that the individual has the ability to regain that right to have their name removed from that database after a period of time. And of course, there's in the bill it lists several things in addition to time that will be taken into account as that judge determines if that's the right decision to make. A couple of things that I want to make sure that we're very clear on here. This is not an anti-gun bill. It's not an anti-individuals with mental health concerns. This is, I think, a very pragmatic approach to some of the concerns that people have out there related to gun sales. Of course, we know that the NRA and the president both indicated after one of the more recent notorious events out there, Sandy Hook, that we should put additional effort into making sure that some of those with the mental challenges have what they need when it comes to services, as well as basically some additional checks to make sure that we are ensuring that gun ownership is placed in the right hands. With that, I would like to hand it over to Morgan and give her a chance to maybe go through just some of the technical aspects of it, and then we'll proceed with the your will, Mr. Chair, from there. Thank you.
Identify yourself for the record, Morgan, and give us your testimony.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Morgan Hobson, staff to Representative Pruitt. The representative did a great job speaking to the bill. In 2013 alone, Alaskans made, or our FFLs, the federal firearms licensees, made over 90,000 inquiries to the database, which is anytime someone tries to purchase a firearm, these people will check to the National Instant Criminal Background Check System to see if there's any reason that they should deny, proceed, or delay the decision to sell that firearm. So what that translates to is about 127 per 1,000 persons in Alaska inquiring each year, which is actually the second highest in the nation for these inquiries rates. Whereas currently in the NICS system, there's only one record, or there's only one name of a person who is precluded from gun membership under federal law for mental health reasons. And this is in comparison to states like Texas, where they have several hundred thousand people in that database. And we have actually in our backup a map showing all of the different states and how many records each of them have. And we're one of very few states that does not report this, even though it is federal law that certain persons, for mental health reasons, if they're adjudicated in the courts, that their name, their date of birth, their Social Security number, state driver's license, if known, be reported to the courts. And that was one thing that we worked with the courts and Nancy Mead, who is present here if there are any questions, to make sure that it was an easy process for them reporting and making sure that all of that information has the provision, if known, was critical, because in many of these cases we don't have all of this information. So once someone goes through the court process, and the adjudication is made by the judge. At that point, the courts would transfer these records immediately. It's the language that we have. Other states, some have looser reporting requirement deadlines. I think Minnesota is 3 business days, and some have as many as within 30 days. But seeing the essence of the issue, we put in immediately. So if there are any questions here, too, we'd be happy to clarify. But the essence of it is that persons who are adjudicated mentally ill, the federal term is different and probably not as up-to-date as the terms that we use in Alaska state statute for persons with mental health issues. But the persons who are precluded are already precluded under federal law, and Alaska just hasn't set up a reporting system for that to take place. So for these federal firearms licensees, they're making these 90,000 inquiries a year. There are a vast number of persons to whom they should not be selling firearms for very serious mental health reasons. And so it's an increased liability to those FFLs and, of course, to us as well. There is also very strict process that we looked at to make sure that it could be appealed later on, and that would make it so that someone could have their name removed from the list. And we've looked at other states where this has been implemented about that appeal process, and we've talked to folks with the NRA who have looked at this process in other states to make sure that the appeal process is very accessible to people but still gives a very high level of scrutiny to their mental health at that time.
Yeah. Any questions for the sponsor?
Thank you, Morgan and Representative Pruitt. So my question is, and I understand that I understand the reasoning for the bill, and I understand the bill. I read it yesterday. But what one thing that I want to point out is adjudicating someone to a mental facility can be done by a parent, can be done by a guardian ad litem. It can be done by someone who is Nancy Mead probably knows all the exact terms, but so my question is, so they haven't committed a crime, but they've been adjudicated to go to the mental health facility, and they spend 30 days or more. Is that how I read the bill? If they spend 30 days or more in a mental health institute, then that those are the people you're precluding.
Yes, through the chair, Representative Millett, to answer the question. If a family member or someone was bring to the attention to the court system that this person needs to be evaluated, then when the judge adjudicated the final decision, at that point, the person's name would be passed on.
So my question is, there's often times when I've done police ride-alongs, and whoever we pick up, we take down, and they're gone to Providence because that's really the only place, I think, in Anchorage that does mental health screening. They hold them for 24 hours, and those people will not be included in this bill, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, you are correct.
Thank you. And then follow-up?
Follow-up.
Thank you. And I understand what the liability is for the gun manufacturers. My other question would be, do you know of the mass shootings that have happened, how many people had been adjudicated and should have been on the criminal background checklist system? I think you mentioned Sandy Hook. I mean, we have the Aurora, Colorado shooting. We have another shooting in Colorado. And from my recollection, most of these people that committed this violence shouldn't have been owning guns anyway because they were under the age of 18 and they had stolen the guns. And so do you think we're fixing a problem, or are we just preventing? I guess what other than the gun owners, the gun manufacturers, is there any other reason why we should be adopting the law?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, that was actually a question that we posed to Ledge Research when we were first looking into this matter regarding what recent incidents this would have actually protected. In Sandy Hook, it would not, because that particular individual did not go through an FFL to purchase those weapons. But examples of shootings that it would have prevented, there's 4 that we have listed here, but Virginia Tech is one. That individual should have been in the database. In 2004, Farron Barksdale was able to pass a background check and purchase a rifle, even though he had been involuntarily committed multiple times, and he ended up shooting and killing two Alabama police officers. Or in 1998, Russell Weston shot and killed two police officers in the U.S. Capitol, even though he had passed a background check but should have been flagged. And there's several others. In 2011, more recently, Jared Loughner went on a shooting spree. I'm reading from Blood's research that he ended up shooting. He killed six and wounded 13, including Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, which we all may remember because it was a recent incident. But there are multiple ones that it would have prevented, but in the case of Sandy Hook, it would not.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted that on the record that we are going to be preventing people that shouldn't have guns.
Okay. Any other questions? I've got one. I'd like to ask it just for the record, but on in page 3, section 3, deals with the term sealing or expunging. Are those terms used at all in the two new sections, sections 4 and section 5?
Section 4 and Section 5, I do not believe it addresses sealing or expunging.
Okay. We heard this bill in State Affairs, and my reason for asking the question, if I could, I just want to put this on the record, is that in a sense, Section 3 is like a reviser's bill. You could take it out. I don't, if I'm reading it right, and I may have missed something, it would make no difference to the bill itself. And so what happened was, as you were looking at, as I understand it, how to make sure that the records were at least, you know, sealed, to use a, you know, actually it's relief from legal disability of record, I think is the actual term of art here in the law. But anyway, this question came up, and so you agreed graciously, and the courts agreed graciously to provide the information for changing Section 3 to be consistent with what is being done. That's what I wanted to get on the record, is that right now, as I understand the section of law addressed in Section 3, right now it's an option for the courts to expunge or seal. But they haven't been expunging. In this particular case, in this particular bill, the driver is that it definitely can't be expunged because NICS is a database that is federal, and so we have no control over that information. So that's how this came up, you know, in the process. I have no problem with it. It was a permissive thing. As far as what the courts were to do, expunge or to seal, but they, in essence, did not expunge. They just sealed. And then, but I assume, and this is a question for courts, and just to put it on the record, you don't have to answer it now, because I don't see it has any relation to the bill, and I think it's just fine in there and all that. But what I'm wondering is if the legislature, as I understand it, we could require expungement, but we could only require expungement in the context of the files that we have in our court system, you know. Yeah. So it would be something novel now to our law, because we don't do that. You know, we gave the option in the past. This bill takes away that option and just goes to the sealing of the records, and that's fine. I think that's all on the record. I think it's all accurate, and I see Nancy kind of nodding her head, you know. So I wanted to clarify best as I could understand it, you know. So, Representative Grimberg.
Maybe we could have Nancy come up for just a minute on this point.
Sure.
I hope we'll come back to you folks, because I did have a question about this, having been in litigation on this subject.
Representative Grimberg, you have the floor.
Could Nancy identify herself, please?
For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, here to answer any questions.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I may dialogue for a moment here, go back and forth.
Not always, but sure. Today you can.
Thank you. It's Monday. Let's hope for the rest of the week. What's the difference between expungement and sealing?
through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, sealing records is, the court has two levels of privacy for court records. One is confidential records, one is sealing. Sealing is much more restrictive. We don't have a means of expunging. If the legislature told the court to expunge records, the court would expunge records. But the definition of expunge isn't anywhere in our rules or anything. Expunge would mean, I guess this is my legal conclusion, the absolute destruction, whether by burning or shredding, of certain court records.
Through the chair. That's my understanding as well. A number of years ago, I represented a young man who was caught in a situation where there happened to be a marijuana plant on the premises. It wasn't his. He was arrested. He wanted to become an attorney, actually. And this was causing the problems. And we filed a motion under the Constitution, basically, and got, with a non-op from the DA, a Superior Court judge, to order the records, quote, expunged. And there was no precedent for that. And I think maybe some people have done that since. But you don't do that anymore, I gather.
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, no, the court system does not expunge records.
Okay. And if it's confidential, the record is there, but it's just marked confidential, right? But somebody can still get it? Is that what happens?
Through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, we have very distinct definitions of sealed versus confidential. Confidential records are accessible by the judge, by the parties to the case, by the attorneys to the case, and for court personnel for case processing purposes only. They're kept in a fluorescent envelope. They are never handed across the counter to somebody, and they are kept off of court view. Sealed records is more restrictive. Sealed records are accessible only to the judge and to somebody with a written court order, not to the judge's administrative assistant, not to court clerks. Nobody can touch those. So those are our two definitions, if that's helpful.
Thank you. Yes, it is. Okay. That answers my question, and I certainly appreciate that. I don't have any objection to Section 3.
Okay. So thank you. Is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify at 366? We have two online, but I just wanted to give the opportunity here first. If I could, we'll go. Representative Gruenberg?
Maybe I missed something. What about the rest of the bill? Is somebody going to talk about that?
Were you done, Morgan? If you'd come back up, if you wanted to summarize the end or whatever.
I thought we stopped at Section 3. Maybe I was wrong.
No.
I
think they were done, I think so. If we could go to public testimony, Jake McGeewen from Connecticut, from the National Shooting Sports Foundation. You have a testimony for us, if you would. Identify yourself for our record and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Jake McGeewen. I'm Director of State Affairs for the National Shooting Sports Foundation. We are the trade association for the firearms industry. We represent over 10,000 manufacturers, retailers, and distributors nationwide. And we actually have over 50 members based in Alaska as well that we represent. So I want to just give a quick rundown of the Fix NICS initiative. This piece of legislation that Representative Pruitt and Morgan have been working diligently on and have been working with us through the introduction of this bill is really a nationwide campaign that we are doing to make sure that the mental health records end up in the NICS system. First and foremost, we are not looking to expand any categories of individuals. We don't want any more prohibited individuals. What we simply want to do is make sure that those people who have been involuntarily committed, which under federal law right now are prohibited from owning a firearm, to make sure that those individuals are in the NICS system. To answer one of the representative's questions earlier about some of the tragedies that this would have avoided, Virginia Tech is one of the highest profile ones where that situation, he would have been in the system and not been able to purchase a firearm. Also, more recently, was the Navy Yard shooter. While he had some situations in Rhode Island. Rhode Island also is one of the states that does not share mental health records with NICS. So those are situations right there which hopefully would have been avoided if this was in place. So we are focusing our efforts on obviously the offenders or some of the worst offenders around the U.S. We have lobbyists and consultants in about 12 states, and we've had a great amount of success both last legislative session and this legislative session. And most recently, over the weekend, the governor of South Dakota signed our Fix NICS bill, which is now in law in South Dakota as well. And really, I want to point out that we as the firearms industry, the last thing that we want to see is any prohibited individual gaining access to firearms. We have our program called Project Child Safe, which focuses on safe storage of firearms. We have our program called Don't Lie for the Other Guy, which tries to stop store purchases so that prohibited people are not getting firearms through store purchases. And then last but not least, the Fix NICS campaign, which we unveiled last year. And just so everyone on the committee is clear, we as a firearms industry are not trying to discourage anyone from seeking any treatment for any mental health issues, from seeing a psychiatrist or actually seeking the mental health. We only want those individuals that have been involuntarily committed and have gone through the process to be included in the NICS system. Nothing, no expansion, and we also want to make sure, which is this is a very important part to us as well as to the NRA, that the appropriate restoration of rights there, and fortunately this Alaska bill does address that very well. Both Representative Pruitt, the courts in Alaska, as well as Morgan, have worked very hard to make sure that the restoration of rights is there. The last thing we want to do is for someone to get the appropriate treatment, go through the process, and not be able to get those rights restored if that is appropriate at that given time. So that really just sums up our testimony and where we are coming from as the Trade Association for the Firearms Industry. And I would open up to any questions for you, Chair, or any other members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Any questions for Jake? I don't see you at this time. Thanks for calling in. Representative Greenberg has a question.
Yeah, as we're going, I'd appreciate if he could stay on the line for a bit, because there may be some questions as we're going on that I would want to come back to him on, if that's okay.
Jake, did you hear the question there from Representative Greenberg? He wants to know if you will stick around in case there's a question.
No problem at all, Chair, and Representative Greenberg, I will be on the line as well. Thank you.
I do have a question, if I could.
No, Representative Greenberg has a question. Go ahead, Representative Greenberg.
Are you an attorney?
You're the chair, Representative Greenberg. No, I am not.
Okay, because some of my questions may relate to something legal in here. Let me just ask either the sponsor or the sponsor's representative or Jake, was this bill based on some other state's law or model act or uniform act? What was the basis for it?
Jake, you have the information on that. Have other states done this?
Yes, through the chair. Representative Gruber, yes, this is a piece of legislation that we have, model legislation that we've used in other states. So yes, we have. Run it obviously based upon each state. We have to craft it differently and make it work obviously for the given state. We usually use a piece of legislation in Mississippi, which passed last year and was signed by the governor, as well as a piece of legislation in Louisiana. But those are the bills we do use. Alaska specifically does not contain all of the categories that we would have wanted to be included. It only includes involuntarily committed, but there are other prohibited categories that could be included in the legislation.
Can I ask you, to the chair?
Representative Greenberg, did you have a follow-up question?
Yes.
Okay, follow-up question, Representative Greenberg.
So this is modeled on Mississippi and Louisiana. Is this very closely modeled or just generally are there significant differences? And was there any other state? You mentioned South Dakota a minute ago. What's the story there? I'd like to find out, you know, if you can, with somebody, where this is so we have some precedent here. I could ask any of you.
Representative Pruitt, did you have a response?
Mr. Chair, actually, if it's okay, I'm going to ask Morgan to come up because she's guru of all these things.
Okay.
And because I know she has the answer. I can answer the last one if you'll come up on the South Dakota.
It doesn't make any difference.
South Dakota just passed theirs this last weekend. So theirs, like ours, was based on other examples.
Yeah, Representative Pruitt, we ask Morgan to come up. If you would identify yourself for the record. And yeah, staff are gurus of these things.
That's right.
Glad they're there, so go ahead.
Mom, again, this is Morgan Hobson, staff to Representative Pruitt. Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we looked at several different states. Actually, Hawaii was one that passed more recently and more closely mirrored our own state statutes and how we draft legislation. So that was one we looked at. We also looked at Colorado as well,
okay.
I believe.
Okay.
You have a question, Representative Grunberg?
Yeah, please. So this was modeled most closely on Hawaii, although you look to Colorado, and I understand South Dakota just passed something, Mississippi has, and Louisiana has. The reason I'm asking is because I have at least one question here based on the drafting of this. And let me find what I'm looking at. It's one word in here. If I could just have a moment. I have circled the word. Okay, page 4, line 19. It's actually in section 4 of the bill, which is a new statute, AS 4730851, and this would be in subsection D as in Delta. A decision to grant or deny relief under this section may be appealed as provided in, and that's the general jurisdiction of the Supreme Court statute. In reviewing the decision of the Superior Court, the standard of review may be de novo. Now, that is not as in any other statute that I'm aware of in this state. The Supreme Court, as I have been admonished by the Supreme Court personally in an oral argument, quote, Mr. Grunberg does not take evidence, unquote. And therefore my scintillating evidence of a life imprisoned person's subsequent life was excluded. So we don't do de novo in the Supreme Court. And the use of the term may is ambiguous. And I would be inclined to want to strike that sentence. Are we talking about here? Ernest, could I have a copy of Title 47?
While you're doing that, if I could interrupt, I believe Kathleen Strasburg is online. She's calling to be online for the 366, and maybe, you know, she could give us some light legal services.
I see we have Nancy here, too. I could ask her.
If Kathleen, if you're online, would you shout out? Not online. Okay.
If we could ask Ms. Mead to come up on it.
Did you want to respond, Morgan? Because if you have some information, well, you are the guru and let's go. I'm not trying to keep Nancy from coming up, but good information. So.
I might be able to give a brief preface to why that was put in there and then turn over the floor to Ms. Mead to further explain. But basically, when we were working with other folks who had implemented this around different states, that was one thing that they repeatedly suggested that we put in, even though our drafter mentioned that it's not a practice here. And so maybe it was something that we did basically to be in compliance with what other groups were doing and wanting. So I might turn it over to Nancy at that point, but yeah. Kathleen Strasbaugh is really the one. And she actually did put together a memo dated February 24th that is in our backup. And I have a copy here if you don't have one on your desk. that explains that whole situation to
Mr.
you.
Mr. Chair, several things. If we could ask Ms. Mead to come up for
Representative Greenberg, if you would, just cease and desist until we get there. Nancy, if you'd come up and join Morgan, I would appreciate it. And Morgan, if you would just stay there, and that'd be great. And that way, if there's more questions. But Nancy, you've heard the dialogue here. If you would, go ahead and give us your...
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I actually don't have an opinion on that sentence. When I spoke with the with Ms. Hobson about this bill, I understood that that was something that was needed in the bill to meet federal requirements and was there for other reasons. I didn't object or ask for a change to that sentence, and we moved on. So I don't have any particular insight about that particular sentence.
Now we have a question, if I could, for Morgan. Did you say there was a response from legal services in our packets?
Didn't see one.
It should be part of the backup. It's a memorandum from Kathleen Strasbaugh that accompanied bill version work order C, which is what we started out with, but it explains the whole process of us dealing with the de novo concept, because for her too, when she was drafting this, she said it was not a familiar term and didn't exactly mirror, but putting...
Yeah, if you would, read it into the record then.
I will.
De novo judicial review of a denial. The state provides for de novo judicial review of relief application denials that includes the following principles. A, if relief is denied by the applicant, may petition the state court of the appropriate jurisdiction to review the denial, including the record of the denying court, board, commission, or other lawful authority. B, in cases of denial by a lawful authority other than the state court, the reviewing court has discretion to receive additional evidence necessary to conduct the adequate review. C, judicial review is de novo in that the reviewing court may, but is not required to give deference to the decision of the lawful authority that denied the application for relief.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And I confess I had not done my homework either, Representative Greenberg. So with that, what I'm going to do is thank you. Yeah, I think we've answered that sufficiently. But let's go ahead. We're going to go to get the rest of the people online.
Could I just say one thing?
Say one thing? Sure. Yeah, go ahead. Representative Greenberg?
Yeah, I don't seem to have that memo. And I would like to really look at that. I specifically would like to see any federal requirement. The thing is that the way this is drafted, it says may, and that's ambiguous. It could be directory or it could be discretionary. The word may is very ambiguous.
Okay. You're thinking that is when you get the paperwork. And Representative Greenberg has suggested that the language in section, and I hope you've been listening, but it says in section 4, page 4, line 19, may require a court rule change. And had you considered that? And if you would give us your response.
Was that question, Mr. Chairman, this is Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services. I only heard part of the question.
I'm sorry. Okay. Representative Greenberg was wondering if the language on page 4, line 18 and 19, they're talking about the standard review may be de novo. And he was wondering several things, actually. I'll let him do it. But one was what the federal requirements that this may address, and then secondarily, whether or not it might require a court rules change.
Well, if my February 24th memo, I understand, is available.
Yes, we have it in front of us, Kathleen. If you would identify yourself for the records and...
Kathleen Strasbaugh, Legislative Legal Services, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, Representative Greenberg, the federal law requires a full hearing at some point, and that is what I read into the federal statute's requirements. Apparently, there are those who don't agree with that, but in any case, the legislation is drafted so that it does not order the court to apply a particular standard of review. It just says that the court may apply that standard of review, and the court does, in fact, use that terminology from time to time to address legal matters and occasionally takes a closer look at factual determinations of the lower court than it might otherwise. But I don't think it's not designed to direct the court or to force the court to apply a particular standard of review, and for that reason I don't think it needs a court rule, and I'm not sure that a court rule would be effective to do that.
Representative Lott has a question.
Thank you. I'm Kathleen. So the way I read it is it's just an option. It's not, and that's why we use the word may instead of shall.
Yes.
It's an option that we could use if we needed to, but it doesn't require a court rule change. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Millett, yes.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up, Representative Greenberg?
I'd like to look at this a little more.
Okay.
It looks like this is a good bill. Don't get me wrong on the bill itself. I want to be sure that we fully understand what we're doing here. Normally, my understanding of a de novo situation is it would be a complete new hearing in front of either the Supremes or a special master. And I have to look at this. I'd be surprised if the law, federal or state, would require that the Supreme Court conduct any kind of a hearing. That's totally unique, except in one case, and that is before the U.S. Supreme Court in disputes between states, mainly boundary disputes. There, they appoint a special master in its original jurisdiction, and occasionally, I guess, in an election dispute in this state, they do that too.
Chair, if I might just add a quick response, Representative Gruenberg, there is a standard of review of de novo review, and they don't conduct a full new trial with witnesses taking oaths and testimony. So that does exist as a way for an appellate court to review the record of the lower court without giving deference to the lower court's opinion. When I read that, I thought that the court could then review it without giving deference to the judge's determinations of fact and make their own decisions in that regard. And also, to echo what Representative Millett said, I read it as discretionary since the word may was there, so did not view it as anything that would require a change to practices.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Green,
I see what you mean, as a law professor of mine used to say. I hadn't read it like that, but I think it certainly could be. And that's probably definitely the way it was intended. I still would like to take a look, because that's usually when you're asking, let's say in this case, an appellate court to review something without deference to the lower court, you provide them a little more direction, whether it should be or it's not. I can see why a federal law would say to the state, you may provide either way. But when we are providing some new law at the state level, I think we'd want to be more specific. And by the way, the case I'm mentioning, I probably ought to get distributed.
Representative Greenberg, you said you'd look into it. We'll assume that is exactly what you'll do, and we'll just press on if it's okay. No, that's all right. There's no problem. We want to get back to Mike, who is online. Thank you, Nancy. Thank you, Morgan. I think we're okay to press on here. Mike Kuhn, are you online?
Yes, this is Mike Kuhn's from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself.
If you would speak right into the microphone, again, state your name and where you're from and what your testimony is on this.
Yeah, this is Mike Kuhn calling from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. Is that better?
Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Okay, couple issues. One, and I may be completely off base on this, but I understand that the Nixus check it is done here in Alaska is through Alaska Nixus, not through the federal system. If that is in fact the case, then if there is a repeal, if a person calls for a repeal on that because they're bettered out and they're no longer a threat to themselves or others or public interest, then how would that person be removed from that Nixus aspect? The other issue and a huge concern to me as a veteran is that the VA is right now turning around and putting people's names into NXIS just because they're being treated for a PTSD. They have never been committed, they have never been adjudicated, but because they're being treated for post-traumatic or a brain injury or whatever from being in combat, or even so much as, you know, just a slight depression and being put on a medication that is relieving that issue, the VA is turning around and going after these veterans. How would can the state of Alaska, through this bill, can they turn around and put a stop to that action for veterans here in Alaska?
Thank you for your testimony, Mike. What I'm going to do is give the sponsor or his staff a chance to respond if they like. Representative Pruitt?
So, this is Representative Pruitt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. In response, to answer the first one, no, there's not a state. Some states do have their own system that they set up to do this reporting. We use the FBI, essentially. To answer the second question, the DEA does not just randomly put information into the NICS database. As a matter of fact, right now there's only one record from Alaska, and honestly no one knows how it got there, to tell you the truth. So that's just not possible. One of the things that, as we described at the beginning here, is the only way for information to be communicated to the NICS database is if there's an adjudication of a 30-day involuntary commitment, and for lack of getting in deeper, there's a threshold there, and it's a high threshold that includes time in front of a judge, etc. So I think that answers the two questions. And if there's anything that my lifelines of Morgan or Ms. Mead want to add to it, I feel free. But I think I've answered both those questions appropriately.
Thank you. Okay, so I think we have covered the public testimony, so we're going to close public testimony at this point.
Mr. Chair?
And Representative Winberg.
I thought I was told Bonnie Nelson would. Yes, Bonnie wants to testify. Is she on the line?
Yes, I'm here.
Hold on. Okay, I missed actually Daryl Nelson too. Back online here. I apologize first, Bonnie. I have four pieces of paper in front of me. I was juggling them, and I missed your name there for testimony. So, if you would identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
I want my son to go first, Daryl Nelson.
That'd be fine, Daryl. If you're there, in Chugiak, if you would identify yourself, give us, state your name and who you represent, and give us your testimony.
I am Representative Keller, through the chair. My name is Daryl Malcolm. For the record, I am the president and organizer of Mind Freedom Alaska. We are a affiliate of Mind Freedom International. We are against this bill. We are against any force and any background check for people that are disabled, mentally ill, of any kind. I want to commend Representative Millett for the House Bill 69 last year. We have supported that bill. We had the Maldine Lions Club sponsor that concept last summer, and I'm against the parent patria, where the government then come in and dictate to you what's best for you, especially if you have any disability at all. You are in danger of losing your civil rights just because you might decide to, for example, you might decide to live on the street because you don't want to be in a nursing home or assisted living home. Therefore, you might be considered mentally ill or mentally incompetent because you're not. They say that may not do the best for you, and the mental health court system is their decision. The judges, their decisions are based on the psychiatric doctors and the psychiatric medication. They are driven. They listen to the psychiatric doctors, and the psychiatric doctors, in most cases, are listening to and driven by the drug companies that for the lack of better word for it, being bought off by the drug companies. And that's dangerous, and if it wasn't for people like myself, I got telephobia and a brain injury that affects the motor function of the body, we are endangered. We are considered possibly dangerous to ourselves, and therefore I've always been afraid that I might be losing my civil rights. It wouldn't take that much to do it if it wasn't for family support, and we think this is going in the wrong direction, and the majority of the we're against the federal banning of mental health laws because I'm a member of the repeal all mental health laws. And also we do have a bunch of members of Mind Freedom Alaska and all over the state and all over the country, so they are keeping track of what I support and what we are doing.
Thank you so much for taking time to call in, Dale. I just, for clarification, this bill does not restrict firearms. That is not what this bill is doing. But Representative Millett has a question for you.
Hi, Daryl. Good to hear from you. You know, I had some of the same concerns that you had, and after reading through the bill and through the legal opinion, only if you are committed to some type of psychiatric facility would you fall under this bill. So it would be a 30-day commitment, and it would be an involuntary commitment. So people with disabilities wouldn't fall under this category. And I worried about that because, you know, I'm on the Governor's Council of Special Ed and Disabilities, and one of the things that I wanted to make sure was that if someone had a traumatic brain injury or had a physical or a mental disability, they are not going to fall under the category of this bill unless you are involuntarily committed to a facility, which I haven't seen that happen very often within the disability community. And so if I'm wrong, correct me, but it wouldn't take any of your civil liberties away at all. Actually, it would protect folks that I would say aren't disabled but have psychiatric problems. I think that's where the difference is that we're talking about folks that have psychiatric problems rather than somebody with a disability or a traumatic brain injury. So I was very concerned about that too, so I wanted to pipe in so you knew that I had looked into that completely.
Bonnie, Dale did a great job. I was wondering if you had something you wanted to add.
Don't forget me. I get to talk next.
No, I didn't mean to go past you. Go ahead.
I'm Dale's mom, and we have worked extensively with the Law Project for Psych Rights, as well as, Dale said, these other international organizations, protection and advocacy centers, such as the Disability Law Center in other states as well. And did Representative Merritt leave? I wanted to speak directly to what she said, because I disagree with her. The majority of people that I have advocated for since Dale's 33 now, and so I've been advocating for him for a lot of years because of his brain injury and the stigma and the discrimination that's happened because he has been labeled all kinds of things that he shouldn't have been, and now has his college degree and has worked as an advocate for 5 years with the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, and was the advocacy coordinator for several years with the Access Alaska. And many people think of people with brain injury as, and in fact it still is defined as mentally defective in some of the laws, such as under the Mental Health Trust. And I have been advocating for many other people besides Dale, and I have multiple disabilities myself and have been discriminated against. Many people we have advocated for that wanted to live on the streets, like Dale said, only you're blind, only you're deaf, only have a service animal, only run a wheelchair. And they were forced into nursing homes, assisted living homes, because they were told they were a danger to themselves. In a separate kind of tracking system, we have civil court, mental health court. They do not have the due process rights they have that criminals have in criminal courts. If a doctor comes in, because judges say they cannot make this, they have to go by the expert testimony, and they don't even listen to the family members, the husbands, the wives, the kids of adults, or the adults of the younger people. They go by, and oftentimes these people cannot choose who their advocate is. They cannot choose who their doctors are that get called before them as expert testimonies in this civil court. And then they get adjudicated for an evaluation of 30 days. And after that, they can lose for the rest of their life to be able to earn income. Jim Gustin is the president, CEO of Law Project for Psych Rights, and he has told me, even though his 30-day commitment was like 30 years ago, he still thinks he can't own a gun now. Because when you go, and I went to the gun store, we decided, Bill and I knew he'd never been for a mental patient, never been in the mental health system because of mental illness. But, like I said, he has a brain injury. So, the thing is, when you go to buy a gun, it says if you've ever been committed, period. And you have to sign yes or no. And if you say no right there, you can't buy a gun. And so we met with many vets and talked about it. The data system has the word criminal in it. So to say that these people that are getting committed because they're determined by a court to be a danger to themselves, maybe they told somebody they wanted to kill themselves or something, or somebody in the family, maybe they're crying too much. They have never broken the law. They have never done anything criminal or violent in any way. They're usually the victims. Instead, they get 30-day commitment because they're determined a danger to themselves because they want to live on the street so they can not get taken off this long waiting period for public housing, because if they live with somebody, then they get kicked off the list. So they have lost. They get committed, they get forced onto Medicaid because of this system that wants to get paid. Nursing Home Association wants to get paid, even the home community-based care wants to get paid on this waiver system. It's all the money, and these people lose their civil and human rights over and over and over again. They do not get to say, because they are determined a danger to themselves, and therefore somebody stigmatizes and profiles them and calls it criminal. They have not done anything criminal. They have not broken the law. They have not done anything violent. They haven't heard a plea, and yet they get on this criminal background checklist. So we are opposed to the United States federal law, so for you to report it, I think you should rethink that. I think the 33 states that are not reporting it are doing a very good thing by saying, hey, this is a states' rights issue. We should stand up and change the federal USC 922G4, because it's wrong to say somebody doesn't have the right to. People with disabilities are the most endangered of being a victim, not being criminals. And we need to be encouraging people that have disabilities to go buy guns, to protect themselves from the criminals. There's no statistics that say people that are diagnosed with mental illness are any more violent or criminal than the average population. And you can ask the Disability Law Center, and he's given us, the director there, David Flatt, sent much information from the Bazelon, which is a very good speaking for the, on behalf of people with mental illness. And they're not criminals. So why should, unless they change the name criminal to this back, and get rid of the name criminal in their background data list, and then we would be, it just doesn't make sense to call people criminals when they're not. And I heard somebody else testify that how can you expunge something that is once into this federal system? It's a states' rights issue, it's a civil liberties issue, it's a right to life and protect yourself against issue. And so I commend Representative Millett again for Hospital 69. We work with many vets groups. We sat at a table, we've got like 300 signatures that supported us on supporting 69, Hospital 69, and because of this very issue that vets with post-traumatic stress syndrome or somebody with that had only done 30 days should not be have a lifetime sentence of never being able to own a gun and lose their Second Amendment rights.
Thank you, Bonnie. I remember when you came down here to Juneau, was I think last year, you and Daryl, and appreciate your time, taking time to testify. But thank you for calling in. We're going to take a little of ease here at this time. We're back on the record. Yeah, thank you. Where was that on the record? I'm off track. It's been a long day. We're going to close public testimony for now. I don't see any questions. There is one question.
I take it we've heard from everybody who wants to testify on the bill. Okay, I have a question. And
now wait, Representative Woodley, who are you addressing your question to?
I think I'm going to address it to Morgan.
Okay.
Although,
what we're going to do is we're going to close public testimony at this point. And if you have questions, we have Representative Pruitt on the staff, and we can certainly call, on the committee, and we can certainly call his staff if there's questions. So the bill is in front of the committee now for discussion and debate. So
it's
Representative Wilbur, you have the floor.
I don't know who to ask this question to. It may be to the gentleman on the phone. But I had a question. It's an act relating to reporting involuntary mental health commitments. And my question is a very basic one. If this is proceeding from the possibility that somebody who is committed may be a danger and should be reported so that people would have a record of this, why is it limited to involuntary commitments? It seems the voluntariness of the commitment may not be the determining factor. Somebody, for example, who didn't want to get reported might be, or was concerned about that, might say, well, I'll commit myself and then you can't report me. Or on the other hand, that may be a pressure to get somebody to commit themselves voluntarily, since they might feel they were going to go anyway, and that way they'd be kept out of the database. And I don't know what should be done, but I'm questioning, why is the voluntariness or involuntariness a determining factor here?
Mr. Chair, and this may actually answer some of the concerns that were brought up earlier. Section 47.30.730 is the petition for 30-day commitment, and then following is 47.30.735, which is the actual hearing itself. If someone were to voluntarily decide to commit themselves, and we were to place their information in, then we have not given the chance for them to go through the judicial process
which is what the involuntary requires, is to go through the judicial process. There's actually seven, just for the petition itself, there are seven different items that must be addressed for the petition, that the petition must include to then potentially move on to the hearing. I would feel very uncomfortable with not having gone through the judicial process of placing someone's name or sending someone's name to the system. So while you indicate maybe a concern that someone could go around the system, I guess maybe that's possible, but I still feel much more comfortable if we leave that in the hands of going through the, all these processes, because I don't want to make it so that I want to. This is a big deal to get to that point. I want to make sure that we go through the judicial process. One thing, if it's okay, Mr. Chair, can I add another point to that? I want to add here that there's a couple things back to the petition discussion, that to even get the petition for the 30-day commitment, which then sends it on to the hearing. There's a couple things I want to highlight. First and foremost, the petition has to be signed by two mental health professionals who have examined the respondent, one of which must be a physician. The second piece that I needed to add is that the petition must allege that the respondent is mentally ill and as a result is likely to cause harm to self or to others. There's six additional pieces to this that are required in the petition. The involuntary commitment aspect of this is not going to grab someone that may have some challenges, maybe through the individual, and I respect Mr. Nelson and his mother for coming forth. It's not going to address necessarily just because you have a brain injury or someone who may be even on the streets with some of this mental concerns. It's a process that even the petition itself is very detailed, and they must show that they could either harm themselves or they could harm others. And I think those are pretty high thresholds for sending it forward. As for the aspect of what this is named, the fact that it's named the Instant Criminal Database, you know, that's one thing that if I ever go to D.C., maybe I could try to change that. But that's on the federal side, and I'm not able to change that piece. I agree that in this case, we are talking about people who may pose a risk to themselves or others, and they may not necessarily be criminals. And I respect that. This law was written over 20 years ago on the federal side, and it would literally, and I'm not trying to be flippant with this, it would literally take an act of Congress to change the name of that that system.
Let's let him follow up first real briefly, if you have a quick follow-up response.
It's on a little different subject.
Okay, then is it a different subject, Representative Millett?
This is to you, Morgan, through the chair. Can you tell me how many involuntary commitments we've had in the state of Alaska in the last 10 years? Do you know the statistics? Can you just read those for us?
Yes, actually I could. Thank you. Find it here in my back.
Identify yourself for the
threshold is incredibly high to have an involuntary commitment. I can't even tell you how high it is. It's really, okay. we're talking about a very few individuals.
Okay. Through the chair, Representative Millett, I would have to dig a little bit deeper into my backup here to find that number, but
if we could, let's ask for how lifeline. Identify yourself again for the record. It makes it easier for the recorder. Representative Millett, did you have a follow-up?
And just to specify, involuntary commitment for people over the age of 18, specifically.
Thank you. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System, through the Chair, Representative Millett. I did gather statistics on mental commitments, and though we have a fairly high number of three-day evaluations. Those are excluded by this bill very specifically. The 30-day commitments, we actually have about, and I don't have the precise numbers, the for other reasons, about 200 or 250 petitions filed per year, and a little under half of those are granted. So I do want to emphasize that it's a very strict process that the judge goes through. We actually, as Representative Pruitt read the statute, there are very strict things that have to be found before those petitions are granted.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Rupert.
Thank you. Another thing that I found that I want to take a look at here, I just would invite any comment through the chair, is back on page 4, line 11. It requires the court to find the relevant facts by a preponderance of the evidence. I assume, and that's not, once again, written the way we normally write draft in this state. Normally we use the active tense. This is in the passive tense, and it doesn't specifically say who has the burden of proof. But I assume that it would normally be the state who brings these actions, the attorney general, but they would have the burden of proof through the chair. To anybody,
I would like to direct the question to Representative Pruitt, and he can cast out a lifeline if he likes.
Representative Pruitt. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe where you're looking is under the relief from the disability.
Oh, so it would be the defendant.
Yes, you're talking about the reversal aspect of this. I think that probably answers your question appropriately.
Well, I'll look at the drafting, because normally we would say if the defendant proves by a preponderance of the evidence. So there's no question.
Right.
Is there something, through the chair, is there some similar language for the initial petition here or in the law as to who has the burden initially?
I may throw a lifeline to Ms. Mead.
From the courts?
Through the chair, I am not certain. I didn't bring my statute up to the table with me. I'm not sure if it specifies what the burden of proof is. It does specify all the findings that the court has to make, if that helps.
I'll think. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to set this bill aside, and we'll let... we've got pretty much everything answered. What's the will of the committee? How's that?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move CS for House Bill 366, State Affairs 28-LS1172/P from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes from committee.
Is there any objection?
Yes, there is. And I have asked for a reasonable amount of time to look at something. I don't think that there was any objection on the merits of that, and I request that I be permitted to do that.
In my understanding, Representative Greenberg, the questions you've raised have been answered pretty much. It's just in lieu of another question that you might come up with. So,
well,
what we will do is go by the will of the committee. If you're going to maintain your objection, you can.
The first thing I raised was on page 4, lines 18 to 19, and it was dealing with the drafting. And, you have the votes. You can do pretty much what you want. I may be the only person on my side of the aisle to look at this thing here.
Representative Greenberg, I have given you way more than ample and equal time today. And like I say, the questions that you have asked have been thoroughly answered, at least in my mind. They're good questions, and I appreciate them. But I would also like to ask you to withdraw your objection if you feel like that we're close in the ballpark here. So
I've asked for the courtesy, and I would like that. I don't see any prejudice. We can take this up the first thing on Wednesday.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Luke.
I don't think it makes much difference, at least it doesn't to me, whether a member of this committee is in the majority or the minority.
That's right.
You're here as committee members, and can't leave, at least I do, I try to leave my party affiliation at that door when we walk into the hearing, and we look at bills, consider bills, cast votes, and so on, according to the best of our knowledge. And I don't think, because you've said several times now, I'm the only member of the minority. Well, so what? I don't think that's appropriate to what we're doing here.
And Representative Greenberg, we try to do the committee so that there's ample time for discussion and debate. We clearly have the votes to move the bill. And in light of the fact that we have other bills pending, in fact, we've got I won't get into the list now, but I'm going to go ahead and call the roll, if you would, Christine.
Oh, I will remove my objection because I have no desire to make a...
Any other objections? Okay. We'll move to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
With individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes. We'll take into these. What we're going to do now is move into HB 369, and I've asked Representative Pruitt present the bill. If you would, go ahead and state your name for the record and tell us about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me another opportunity to present another bill. Representative Lance Pruitt, represent District 25, which is in East Anchorage, and the bill that's before you is HB 369. HB 369 came about from actually my own reading, to tell you the truth, reading various articles out there from some of the CSG magazines, some of the others, as I tried to kind of gain some of the best practices from other states. And one caught my eye, and it was the idea of a limited immunity from criminal prosecution for certain offenses, drug offenses, you know, for basically someone that's experiencing an overdose. We went ahead and looked into it a little bit more, and there are several states, I believe it's 14 states currently, that have implemented a form of this limited immunity. And one of the best examples, and actually you should have in your packet, it's from Ledge Research, a little bit of analysis that's been done in Washington that indicates that, kind of indicates what would could come about from this. And then to be clear, this isn't a focus on the legal aspect of an individual who has had a drug abuse. We're not really trying to focus in on should we send them to jail, all those kinds of things. What we're really trying to look at is the health aspect. This is a public health discussion. An example that I actually had from one of these many articles that I had the chance to read was an example of three friends. Two, and I've mentioned this to many people, so I'm sure most people have heard this as I've talked a little bit about this bill. Two friends driving around while their friend is in the back overdosed on some form of drug. I believe it was actually an opiate of some sort. And they were driving around hoping he would just come out of it. And in turn, he never came out of it. He ended up dying in very close proximity to a hospital as they were fearful of the repercussions of trying to help their friends, of the legal repercussions. So what you have before you is really something that, as you might find from, I don't have details specifically in Alaska, but in Washington, they found that most of the police officers there, when they came to an overdose scenario, the likelihood of them actually arresting that person or the people or the friends around was actually rather low. But most people that are in that situation or would be afraid to be in that situation, immediately in their mind comes to, what are the legal aspects? Do I go to jail? All of those pieces. So what we have done here is we have tried to bring into account when someone is in that scenario, let's not make them have to make the decision between their friend and whether or not they go to jail if they make a good faith effort to assist their friend. Now, let's be clear on here. We've spent quite a bit of time ensuring that this does not mean that a drug dealer or a trafficker can get out of jail free card. That's not going to happen. Not only is it good faith, they have to stay with the person, and if it's indicated when they open up the back of their car, when they're dropping them off and dealing with this, that there's enough drugs to supply a bunch of people, then obviously that person is not doing this for what is essentially their personal use or for their friend's personal use. It also doesn't give an opportunity for someone to do it multiple times. So let's say that someone's doing this is their fourth time in the last year. It's limited to that first instance is the goal that we're really trying to help people get their lives back on track without being worried that they have to make the choice between dying or their friend dying or going to jail. So with that, I'll pass it. I would pass it over to Morgan if she's got any technical, and I think she may have some technical discussions, and then pass it back to you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, if I could have a question before you leave.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, there's no intention of moving this bill today. We're just looking at it for presentation, and what is it your intent that you have your staff go over the U version or the blank CS version? Tell me what.
If it's okay, I'd like to have her go over the blank CS because we spent some time with both Ms. Strassbaugh as well as the Department of Law, and we went over both. They were trying to make sure we got to what we needed to, and I think it would be appropriate to. This is what came out of that, and appreciate if we could speak to that one.
Okay, so the committee has before them version LS 1515 November of 369, and that's what your staff is going to be going over. And just so everybody knows, we have Lieutenant Dial online from the Alaska State Troopers. Kathleen Strasberg is online from Legal Services, and I see Annie is here from the Department of Law. So with that, yeah, if you would, Morgan, go ahead. Representative Grunberg, do you have the end version?
Are you?
Okay. Go ahead.
Through the chair, this is Morgan Hoffson, staff to Representative Pruitt. When we first began to look at the ramifications of this bill, of course, our primary interest was to make sure that this would not be granting immunity to persons who had the intention to distribute or manufacture. And the reason we have a blank CS is because it did take quite a bit of work with our drafters and with the Department of Law to come up with something that worked for everyone. So what we have here on this version lists out specifically which possession charges this would grant immunity to. And we do have Kathleen Strassbaugh online to talk about those differences. Primarily, when you look at Washington State, which is a great case study for this, and it's included in our backup under the documents that Ledge Research supplied, when they first polled users, these users before that law went into effect, about 50% of them said that they would call in with, regardless of their fear of legal ramifications. And then after this bill was passed, 88% said that they would call in. And so in Washington State, the idea was to create some kind of reinforcing assurance to these people that they could call in, even though in general it sounds like police wouldn't make arrests for a small possession offense in this case. With the main focus being on, of course, saving the life of the individual that is overdosing. I would like to add on a question that was posed to us outside of committee that I would like to address, is what kind of treatment the individuals who do overdose get once they are attended to by emergency services in the hospital. And I'd like to give an example just from our local hospital here in Juneau, where they actually have a person on staff who deals with the top 20 substance abusers, and so those persons would generally fall into that category to refer them out for treatment. And if there were other questions, we'd be happy to address them, but the main issue that we wanted to go through here with you all is to get a good consensus on where the appropriate threshold was as far as using this as immunity for persons who had possession but who were not distributing or manufacturing.
So non-controversial, maybe I spoke too quick. We can just pass the bill.
Mr. Chair.
No, I'm just kidding. Representative Millett.
Again, and I appreciate the bill because, like I said, I've done extensive ride-alongs with police officers. And some of the things that I've seen and some of the things that I have witnessed is people that were left alone after a drug overdose because nobody wanted to be part of the legal problem that came along with reporting someone overdosing because they were also using or had possession of a small quantity of drugs. And so I would imagine that this will save, you know, a lot of people's lives. And I think once you go, from my experience and not my personal experience, but my experience from talking to people that have had drug and alcohol issues, mostly drug issues, is once they overdose, that is rock bottom for them. And they do turn their lives around. It is not something that is pleasant to go through. I don't know if you've ever seen anybody go through in the hospital when they do have a drug overdose, how they treat the patient. It's not pretty. It's not it's not an exciting thing to watch. It's pretty grotesque and horrible. And the aftermath is even worse for days on end of someone that's gone through a drug overdose. And I'm just making clear it's not me, but I have seen this happen, and it is, I believe, a safety net for keeping people that are addicted to drugs from dying. And so I appreciate the bill, and I understand it very well. And if you've ever done ride-alongs, we have a very large contingent of people that are experiencing heroin overdoses right now and being left to die in the streets, in homes, at parties. And it is just usually young kids who have one-time experience with heroin or one-time experience with meth is the other problem that we have. But I would just say that if you look at our statistics from, and maybe Officer Dial can give you some of those statistics about what is going on with heroin currently right now, it's pretty phenomenal. And I the drug culture in Alaska is changing fundamentally to a young person's game. And it's not something that I think we want to turn our noses at. But so I appreciate the bill, and I understand it. And I think it will actually help save lives of those that are hitting rock bottom, Mr. Chair, for what it's worth.
Representative Lynn?
Thank you. I have no patience with drug abuse in all varieties. I'd like to see the laws strengthened rather than weakened. But I'm also pro-life. And we can't allow somebody not to be admitted for treatment with the fear of being prosecuted for this offense. Now, there are sideboards on this, as I understand it, where it's kind of a one-time free get out of jail before you go to jail ticket, if I'm correct. But you know, life comes first, and then we'll try to deal with these other issues later. So I basically like the bill. I'm concerned about drug abuse. Need to throw these people in jail, but first we need to save their life. And I think this bill is a step in that direction.
Representative Pruitt, this version in, as I understood it, as it was presented to me, there was still some, it was still a work in progress. I'm just guessing, does it have to do with making sure it's tight enough so that it can't be gamed? And, you know, maybe that's more, you know, if you would, just kind of give us an idea of what you're working on. I would appreciate it.
That's exactly what we were working on, is to make sure that it was tight enough that we weren't allowing people to take advantage of it. I believe at this point in time we have both our drafter, Ms. Strasbaugh, as well as Ms. Carpinetti. I believe they have this is the version that they've come to agreement on that makes sense and does not make that loose. I would prefer to have them speak to that. Now, I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but that was kind of a holdup, is to make sure that we got to that point, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Kathleen, you called in just to answer questions, and there hasn't been, I don't think any, maybe there has been kind of general questions. Do you have something to respond here to?
Mr. Chairman, Kathleen Strauss, Legislative Legal Services. I would certainly defer to the sponsor as to whether the draft achieves the sponsor's objectives, and we did work with the Department of Law on this particular one. I don't know if there's other issues that need to be discussed, and I'll just stand by.
Okay, great. We have a question, Representative Greenberg, for you, Kathleen.
Yeah, this is for either Kathleen or Ms. Carpinetti. I've talked, I think, both of these folks about the fact that we seem in most bills involving new criminal laws, Section 2 on applicability. And that, I think, is the general rule. It applies to offenses occurring before, on, or after the effective date of the act. Although I'm not totally sure about that. I wonder if they could, if we could get maybe Ms. Carpinetti up here.
Kathleen, do you have a response?
Yeah.
I think there's in this particular bill, which is a defense rather than an offense. Mm. Actually, it's an immunity, not even a defense.
Yeah, that's right.
It's sort of a general formulation that we used to put within the bill itself how it applies.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenberg.
What I'm thinking, it seems that we generally have a Section 2, and that's right, this is, basically an affirmative kind of a defense. But what I'm thinking is, and I'm sort of using this as an opportunity today to make a suggestion here. And the question is whether instead of having this sort of a general thing in most of these criminal laws, we should have something in Title 11, possibly, or actually should be in Title 12, that unless the bill says otherwise, the change occurs for if it's a new crime, we'll say, conduct occurring on or after the effective date of the act. And I'm just wondering if we should, as a committee, explore whether we should put that into a general section in the Code of Criminal Procedure, because we seem to have it regularly in most of these criminal laws. If we could ask Ms. Carpinetti to come up for a second, I could ask her that.
Yeah, thank you, Kathleen, and thank you for your presentation. I don't see any other questions for the sponsor at this time. No. Yeah, I'm sure we'll have Andy come up from the Department of Law. Yeah, of course. That is.
Well, I hope so.
Back on the record here shortly and let Andy Carpinetti from the Department of Law respond to Representative Greenberg, but we're not going to go on long dialogue or anything. Go ahead and make your statement, and we'll gavel out, and then with the understanding that this bill will come back before us. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Andy Carpinetti, and I represent the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, and I was coming up to respond to Representative Greenberg's suggestion about a prospective general effectiveness of criminal laws. And frankly, I think it's already in Title I that generally, unless there's an effective date, that the a clear indication of legislative intent to have a law be retrospective, that new bills are already prospective. But I would like to find that, because I haven't looked at it in a while, and provide it for you.
Mr. Chair.
Andy, I would appreciate when we come back to the bill if you could give us a little bit of a one-on-one on that.
So, sure.
Okay.
I need to.
Representative Greenberg?
Mr. Chair, when I served in the 1980s, we didn't have these kinds of sections too and stuff, but it seems to be the practice now, and I don't know if that was because of one particular person who worked over at Ledge Legal, who's not primarily doing this now or what, but this seems to be the practice. And if in fact that is answered by the general retrospective statutes, then we probably should just be striking these and not putting them in the bills at all.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gruber, I understand, because I know when I first started doing this sort of work, we didn't have applicability sections in every bill like we do now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's partly maybe our legislative section that is looking to do them. And especially for criminal laws, it's important to, it's more important, I think, to clarify the legislature's intent on whether or not something should be prospective or retrospective. But I would love to look back on that and come on Wednesday and give you a definitive answer.
Thank you. Representative Grunberg, or no dialogue, if we could just press on, but is it a final statement?
Yeah. Because it seems that either we should have it generally, if we're going to do it, or not. But just to throw them in every single bill doesn't make a lot of sense if we're following the general rule. We should only do it if for some reason we're not. Okay.
That's great for consideration for next time. What we're going to do is gavel on now, and we probably will not get to this bill on Wednesday, because we have at least an hour. We're going to get a report from the CACFA, the Citizens Advisory Commission on Federal Areas, and then we want to at least introduce HB 373, which is on 24/7 testing, because we want to get that look at that before we look at the crime bill that is coming our way from the Senate. So that's the intent for Wednesday. HB 127, the Ombudsman bill, is still pending, but likely we will not get very far on that on Wednesday either. We'll try, but we'll put that last on the list. So with that, we'll gavel out at 3:05.